The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Today, I'm fulfilling a request. Somebody, more than once, has asked me to deal with St. Augustine, specifically with St. Augustine in a metaphysical and Orthodox context. One of the things that we've done on this show, and has become a theme of this show, is to provide the basic foundational thought of the Platonists, and especially the Church Fathers, all of whom were Platonists of one kind or another. And the purpose of me dealing with a lot of these people is to provide a radically alternative view of reality and our place in it than is normally promoted and, in fact, enforced in both capitalist and socialist societies, both ideologies based on a mechanistic and materialist view of reality. And that view of reality has become normative for almost the entire world. And because of that, it becomes part of the default thinking mechanism of the average person. And needless to say, that affects every aspect of human life. And so I'm willing to say that a lot of our problems, both in the capitalist and the post-socialist world, is this materialist and mechanistic worldview that has created the bureaucratic mentality. And I think the central evil in modern thinking is a metaphysical doctrine called nominalism. In very simple terms, the idea that nature as such doesn't have meaning, in that it is a mechanized conglomeration of pieces forming a system. But that system is largely of random creation, which is almost a logical contradiction, but that's the basic theory, and that there are only individual things that we find useful, and then we as a society put names on those things, and that's really all they are, is what we name them, and hence the word nominalism. And of course, the entire Orthodox tradition, whether it be Eastern and Greek or Western and Latin, was vehemently opposed to this idea. This idea was well known at the time because the ancient Greeks had at least some, however minor, nominalist types of thinking in its early philosophy. And so much in the patristic philosophical tradition is Platonic. And so In dealing with that, we are, in fact, challenging the prevailing nominalist and mechanistic approach to reality. So that's the point of this whole thing. We're trying to offer what is a much more rational approach to reality. And St. Augustine is a dominant figure in metaphysics. His metaphysics actually is relatively unique in the sense that it starts from the will, rather than the intellect. And this is something that's not going to develop again until the early 19th century with Hegel. And the central Augustinian idea is our existence in the ever-changing world of objects. However we want to define these. And one of the arbitrary elements in nominalism is that objects are taken as these singular things. And that's a problem because objects always exist in systems and relations and organizations. And reality is actually, from the point of view of our senses, is really a system of organizations. And so taking an object is an abstraction. Objects exist in relation with many other things. So nominalism is arbitrary in that respect. But the concept is this. In our inner world, governed by the will, we are deeply alienated. And we're deeply alienated because we seek satisfaction and stability in this world of changing and moving things. And of course, because they're always moving and changing, we can never find satisfaction there. So there is this constant anxiety. And I want to say that this is probably the first expression of anxiety as a philosophical concept. And only in the 20th century, only in the existential world, in the existential philosophical world, will this come up again. Augustine is really the founder of this way of thinking. Now, in the outer world, we have the real problem of how we live in this world of multiplicity. Our fallenness is manifest in the fact that we live within and among multiplicity. God is pure unity. And coming from Plato and Plotinus and to some extent the Stoics, St. Augustine will posit this descending realm from God, God the Father, that is, this descending realm of forms, intellectual forms, leading to the manifestation of these forms, the actual objects that are always changing in our world. So we go from absolute unity to extreme multiplicity. Our alienation derives from the fact that we often take this world of multiplicity, these always changing and moving objects and emotions and everything that swirls about us in our life, as real. And it is not. Or if it's real, it's only relatively so, not absolutely so. And so the concept of original sin here is fairly simple. The proof that we are fallen creatures is that we take this sensible world of ever-changing things to be real. And so our task is to rise above it. And so the problem with modernity and the modern way of thinking is that it takes these objects in space and time, organizes them in a mechanistic system, and then claims, in making an ontological and hence non-scientific claim, that this is all that exists. Nominalism is the handmaiden to that particular ideology, because nominalism says that there are no forms, there are no real stable definitions. Ultimately, nominalism concludes with the idea that the state and the scientific establishment alone have the authority to decide what is real and what is not. And there is no inherent reality to objects. They don't have any inherent definition. They have no inherent purpose or function. And therefore, meaning is created and imposed on things. It is not discovered. And that's a dirty little secret of the modern scientific establishment, to the extent that it follows the nominalist idea, which I think it has to do. It inherently has to be nominalist, although it rarely argues for that. In that there is no definition or purpose in nature. We have to, in fact, impute it and then impose it on the natural world and then present it to the public as if this is something that we have discovered. So when you deal with Augustine, the chief church father and metaphysician of the church in the West, he was from North Africa and was a Latin speaker primarily. And his central idea is that there's an inner and outer world, the inner world of will, the outer world of objects, and they're related through this existential anxiety. And our world, therefore, to the extent that it is unredeemed and that there's no further reality than this world of multiplicity, our state is one of constant anxiety because we seek the satisfaction in that which cannot give us satisfaction. Our intelligence, however, never actually sees bodies. Our senses see bodies, see objects in space and time. Our intelligence only sees concepts. God essentially created one form of the soul, and out of that derives all the forms, the soul being the form of the body. All of our souls are created by God at the instant of our conception, but derived from the initial form of Adam. This is the very same form of human nature in general that Christ took to himself at the incarnation, joining it without mixing it, but joining it with the form of divinity. That is to say, what God is in his nature. So the sin of Adam has been destroyed in the sense that we enter the church, which is, in fact, the manifestation of this union between human and divine. His view of the soul is that it does not pre-exist, although he suffered with this concept. There is a human nature, but our soul derives from this particular human nature, and the derivation comes into existence at the moment of our conception. But what he does reject in his letter number 166 is that he doesn't like the idea of this genetic connection between all the souls that have been generated since Adam's time. There is a new soul, an aspect of human nature that is created anew at conception. Therefore, the payoff of all of this is that our soul's status is one that has fallen but does not partake of Adam's initial sin. However, it does partake of the damage done to human nature. And that damage is an inborn tendency to sinfulness. But sin is not an action. And this is relevant to any concept of the soul, because it isn't an action. It is a habit of mind that derives from our fallen state. Our fallen state, the condition of human nature deriving directly from Adam, within which our soul participates. This tendency, this inherent tendency to sin, revolves around the idea that we have this inborn desire to connect our wills to that which does not last, to that which is alienated from God, and it connects us to things that are not stable and then in and of themselves cannot make us happy. That could include nature worship, that could include food and drink, it can include women, it can include the state, it can include money, it can include any of these things that we think are good but in fact never truly satisfy us. And St. Augustine is particularly sensitive to this because he went through in his younger years many different philosophical schools and many different trends and fads, not unlike our own present academic environment where fads and fashions govern everything and no one ever asks where these in fact come from. The point is that our soul is damaged because it partakes in the damaged human nature that comes from original sin. Original sin is this near worship of the world of multiplicity, which takes its theological form in paganism or fetishism, where it takes social power, natural power, and fetishizes it into a person or a concept. And that is this, and the chaos of the pagan gods fighting one another. Again, this is also something that Augustine was steeped in his life. He lived within the Roman Empire. And he is steeped in this pagan mentality, and he sees it as this chaos, but a chaos that makes a lot of sense, because it's a chaos that derives from our own experience in this world of continually changing and contradictory multiplicity. And the way that people have tried to make sense out of this multiplicity really is just another word for paganism. The mechanistic connection of concepts to try to make sense out of the chaos around us. The fact that it gets fetishized into gods and goddesses and forces like the fates or whatever is simply a way that the alienated will has dealt with the chaos of nominalism. So these things are a projection, so to speak, in Feuerbach's sense, of the alienation that Augustine makes at the very basis of his approach to human nature. Now, the fact that we are embodied means that we can't help but feel oppressed by the fact that we live in this ever-changing universe. And not only the objects around us and our feelings about those objects around us change, but the theories about how we're to understand these objects are also always changing. This alienation is similar to what you have in Heidegger and the existentialists, is that we have this interior will, we have this drive, we have this, we want to love. Love in the true metaphysical and platonic sense of the world, to become a part of and participate in divinity. It's not that saccharine, sappy idea that the middle classes in America use. Now, love is something very specific and very platonic. We want to become a part of divinity, because there and only there do we have peace. Do we have this unchanging foundation where truth, with a capital T, can be found and enjoyed permanently. Yet unless that is manifest on earth, as it is now in the church, the human mind will begin inventing whatever it takes to provide some kind of peace and quiet for itself. And that accounts for the ancient religious tradition, and to a great extent, Plato himself. Reason exists as a ladder for us to go from the particular to the more universal. Plato was only able to go so far. And what becomes very common in the patristic idea is that Plato posited the form of the good, which all things, to the extent that they exist and function, partake in. But we have no direct access to that. It took the incarnation of Christ to take the form of the good and bring it to earth and then form a church within which we can experience that form directly. And only after the incarnation can that actually make any sense. In Plato's time, the form of the good was something eternally distant. I could say the same thing about Yahweh in the Old Testament. You know, they're actually very similar concepts, except that Yahweh has a personality and the form of the good in Plato does not. But other than that, they're the same thing. And the problem with both of them is that they have no direct connection to the world of humanity. Only the incarnation permits that, and that is why the incarnation is necessary. Reason is a way that the will can slowly but surely go beyond multiplicity and begin understanding truth in its formal capacity. The will places reason in motion. It's this alienation that forces us to cultivate our rational faculties. Ultimately, these truths lead us to something like Plato's form of the good. That truth within which all true things, or that goodness within which all good things participate. Truth is one, therefore, at its highest level. Goodness is one. Beauty is one at its higher level, and everything else participates within it. But the concept of love, this idea of uniting yourself to that which is divine and unchanging, has its redeemed quality and unredeemed quality. Fallen man, like our middle class yuppie in America, views love as simply using something, using a person or an institution to get to something else. And they call this love. And that's pretty much what love is today. And normally I'm confronted by people who believe that love is pretty much doing whatever it is that's in their interest at the moment. That love somehow is indulgence. But that's ridiculous. It's a typical modern mockery of the term. And yet the redeemed form of love is something very different. It is the concept of enjoying. Ultimately, Augustine's idea is happiness. Happiness is the end of life. The problem is that the things that most people think make them happy are radically irrational, and that's an empirically verifiable fact. But enjoying is clinging to that which exists for itself, for its own sake, and there's nothing beyond it. And, of course, that could only be God himself. So when we're talking about the things of this earth, charity is a virtue that has to do with using earthly things for the sake of enjoying eternal things, where cupidity is really about using earthly things as if they're the only reality. And that's really the big difference between the patristic and orthodox point of view and the modern point of view. Earthly things are symbols in the sense they point to something beyond themselves. They point to something more developed, more coherent, better than themselves. But God can be found in nature. He is not identical with nature, but he can be found in it. And he could be found in it through the fact, as we've said many times on this show, that nature is regular and is governed by laws. The law has to exist prior to nature. Laws cannot evolve. The laws of evolution themselves cannot evolve. Therefore, laws have to exist prior to the existence of matter, and therefore they exist in logos, and it's that logos that becomes incarnated in Christ and is our direct connection to natural law. But that is a difference between charity and cupidity. We look at earthly things as manifesting the eternal, and therefore we use the things of the earth to enjoy the things of eternity. And yet the overwhelming majority of humanity views the world in a lustful way, in that we want to use the things of the earth because we think that that and that alone is going to make us happy. Or even worse, that and that alone are the only things that exist. Anyway, we're going to finish St. Augustine when we come back. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
EU leaders have gathered in Brussels for an emergency summit on how to come up with the cash promised for a second bailout to Greece. The heads of state are said to be considering a new bank tax to payroll Athens and stave off a looming default. But with Italy and Spain now showing the first symptoms of the debt epidemic, there are fresh tensions between the attendees. Squabbles have already broken out, with Germany pessimistic about the summit and France calling for bloc-wide unity. But as RT's Daniel Bushell reports, the infighting is continuing while the euro's future hangs by a thread.
The single currency will be dead within 2 years, warn analysts.
Within the European debt crisis, there's a really very serious threat now that the euro might disintegrate and that the eurozone might collapse.
It's already too late to save the Greek economy, according to a majority of leading economists and experts polled by RT.
Greece is really going down the drain completely. The debt is escalating, the deficit is totally out of control.
If I could give you the analogy that they were like somebody with a gambling problem or a drinking problem, but the Greek people are not prepared to accept it. It's a cultural thing. So now we find ourselves with someone with a drink problem, but with a huge debt as well. And the problem will only ever get worse until you actually confront reality and say, look, they don't fit in the Eurozone. They're not going to fit together with Germany in one single euro.
Politicians in richer states and their voters refuse to foot the bill.
Well, I don't think I've ever met anybody in the United Kingdom and in London, my constituency, that actually wants to contribute to the bailout of countries like Greece and Italy and to contribute to the continued existence of the euro, because they think it's a stupid idea to start with and it's just chucking money down the drain.
Yet pulling the plug on those states could trigger a chain reaction. Greece believe investors can no longer avoid quitting the euro. That in turn will spark the exit of Ireland, Portugal, even Italy and Spain.
Greece, Ireland and Portugal, everybody said, okay, the bugger's going to stop there. Over the last couple of weeks we saw that also spreads with Spain over Germany, Italy over Germany started to go on.
Europe's top banks hold billions of euro in Greek and Portuguese debt. If those countries go bust, they could lose that money.
We might see scenarios like a bank run. That means that people will run to the bank in order to withdraw their deposits because they believe that the bank might not be able to pay them.
The euro's facing an existential crisis, admits German Chancellor Angela Merkel. But the head of Europe's biggest economy warns they still might not find a compromise at the Brussels.
Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to The Orthodox Nationalist. We are dealing with St. Augustine and the metaphysics and metaethics of St. Augustine. And I'm dealing with this, I guess, in part because in the Orthodox world, as some of you might know, there is a certain hostility to St. Augustine. And these are often people without a philosophical or metaphysical education, and they often don't understand the person who they're attacking. Reading St. Augustine is never easy, partially because you really have to, prior to picking up St. Augustine, you have to have mastered Plato and the Neoplatonists and the Stoics to some extent, and then recognize the historical context within which all of these influences come together in Augustine's thinking. Because so many of the things that Orthodox people attack Augustine on often are means whereby Augustine is attacking his opponents. And many of Augustine's critics have not read the bulk of his works, even though that's no easy trick. I have done it, but it's taken me many, many years to do it and to understand his metaphysical point of view and why he's taken the positions that he does. And a lot of these people do not have an education in these matters, and this is a very complicated issue. And I want to state again that people have no right to an opinion if they are not expert in the field. If they're an expert in the field, they have a right to an educated opinion. If they are not, they need to shut up and ask questions rather than make statements. And especially when you're dealing with a highly technical field with its own vocabulary like metaphysics, which really was the heart and soul of Augustine's approach to everything, because he's talking about the nature of reality, both in its illusory form and its real form, and the problems of being a human being, that is to say, being an embodied will that can use reason either to find truth or to justify its vices. This is the central concept of Augustine. Augustine has a tremendous amount of sympathy for humanity. because he sees humanity being constantly in the state of anxious confusion over what to believe, what to follow, what is true, and what is fraudulent. And ultimately, whatever the person will choose as his purpose in life can be justified by the will, using reason for its own purpose. This is the attractive aspect of this voluntarist, will-centered approach. And Augustine's point of view is that the will is what matters. The intellect, especially in our fallen world, follows behind it and justifies whatever the will does. Somebody with an evil will do whatever he pleases, and of course, reason can always be mobilized to justify anything and everything. A good will is a different story. A good will is a seeking will, one that wants to find that which will permanently make it happy. And we know from experience that the things of this earth cannot do that. So either God is there to provide us with the means of stability and happiness, or the existentialists are correct and life is absurd. The human will is free, according to Augustine, and that's the problem. Sin comes from the free will, deciding really on the basis of vividness, the fact that the empirical world is in front of our face all the time. The intellectual world takes a lot of work to get to. And this is the problem. The intellectual world, the world beyond cause and effect, the world that is not mechanistic, it is not nominalist. These are truths in a general and essential sense. They are hard to reach. It takes a lot of work to rise above the world of cause and effect. Most people won't do that work and are essentially satisfied with living the sort of the piggish life of the pleasures that come and go, that are, as Plato would say, mixed with pain and discomfort that exist in this lower world. There is a higher world that only the intellect can understand, and that is a Platonic world of the forms. And when these guys who don't like Augustine read him, they forget that Augustine is assuming that his readers are aware of the Platonic, the Plotinian, the Ciceronian, and general Stoic approach to the world. He assumes this. And most of the people who read this don't have a clue as to what he's talking about. And so they have a tendency to impute to him whatever they want. And that's just an example of the Augustinian idea of the bad will. The will becomes what it loves. If the will loves the world and its power and its force and its mechanistic and nominalistic approach to things, it will become like it and it will die. I have said on this program that the soul of the human being is not inherently immortal. It dies. It becomes a part of the earth because it loves the earth. It worships the earth, in fact, which is the very essence of paganism. The fetishization of natural and social forces. But the problem is that the soul is the home of the will and the intellect, and it is dominated by will. There is another aspect to humanity, and that is the spirit. That is not inherent to the human person. That can only be given by baptism and the life within the church, because the church, the point of it, is to provide even to the simplest person, not just to the handful of philosophers, as Plato would say, but to provide to the simplest of people access to the form of truth with a capital T, good with a capital G, which is God. To be able to do this in a symbolic manner, that is the church, and that these symbols at the end times will be revealed to the elect. The remainder simply die and go to the dust because there is no spirit, therefore there's no aspect of them that is immortal. Now, I'm not sure if Augustine would go that far. I generally hold that that's the case, that most people simply die and are not immortal. They don't go to heaven or hell. They don't go anywhere. They simply die and decay because their will has conformed itself to the earth to such an extent that it becomes a part of it. The will becomes what it loves. The will is driven by this love and becomes united to whatever it is that it loves. And in our world, sometimes we call that compulsion. We call it obsession. We call it insanity. This is what happens to, in an extreme case, when our love of the earth and its power becomes so overriding that our will is in fact transformed to some extent into what it loves. The will is free in Augustine. It is free from external coercion. It is not free, however, from the fact that the powers that govern this world, both in a spiritual and in a political social sense, are far more vivid than the forms of the intellect. Now, God can and does affect the will internally via baptism and life within the church. The church is a means. It's a means to regenerate this will that only seems to lean to the life of sin. Sin is a life. It is a habit. It can be manifested in action, but it's not essentially in action. It's a way of thought. It's a view that holds that the earthly world and its power structure is the only reality, and that alone can make one happy. And that, in turn, leads to the bureaucratic mentality, the fetishistic mentality, the idea that I have to have certain things in order to appear superior, this mindless, anxiety-ridden alienation that most people live in. And sometimes they find some limited solace in drugs or alcohol or in political ideology or in mainstream religion, which is probably worse than all of those things. And it just lives a life of mindless conformity. Now, the concept of evil here is closely connected to everything that we've been talking about. All things are good in the sense that they are aspects of Logos, God's creative power in this world. They perform a function. They are part of a broad system. And to that extent, they are good. Evil, it's a commonplace. Every freshman in college has heard this in their philosophy class, that evil is a negation. It doesn't exist in and of itself. It is a negation from being. But what does that mean? Most professors who teach these 100-level classes don't know anything. And they often don't define these central concepts. The idea that evil is non-being means that there is a gap in our fallen world. And this also comes, and it really comes to form the much later existentialist school, that in our fallen world, one of the marks of this fallenness and perversion is that no matter what we look at, no matter what we might contemplate, including ourselves, there is always this gap between what a thing is in its essence and what a thing is in its day-to-day function. We may have a very exalted view as to what we're doing in this world. Most people don't know or even know how to ask the questions as to what they're doing, never mind having an intelligent answer. But for those of us who try to think differently, we have a very exalted sense of what we do in this world, and yet we realize that in our day-to-day life, we often do not reach that standard. It's very easy to attack Orthodox people who have extremely high standards of behavior. It's very easy to accuse them of falling and sinning. It's something that we do every day. But when you have a standard that's so high, the apostolic standard, the Christ himself, and the prophets, these are our standard. When you have that standard, failure is pretty much built in. But that doesn't mean we abandon the standard. And it's easy for people who have no standards to attack us for failing to achieve this extremely high standard. Christ gave us the standard, and he called it perfection. This is what you strive to. But for St. Augustine, this is something very specific and very technical. It is the full joining of our essence and our existence. What we are as a person, an object, a thing, participating in logos, being part of God's plan on the one hand, and actually how we live and think on the other hand. That distinction is evil. That's the very definition of evil. And it is nothing with a capital N, because it's really just, it's a gap. It's an abyss between how we were made and what we in fact are. But this becomes a habit. Sin is a problem because it's addicting. All sins are addicting. Once we habituate ourselves to living within and caring only about objects in our world, cause and effect, the nominalist approach to things, power and authority, the state, bureaucracy, the corporation for which we work, whatever it is, once we habituate ourselves to that kind of life, it becomes almost impossible to pull ourselves away from it and begin to contemplate that which is above it, the forms of truth and goodness. But this is what God calls us to do. The only way it can be done is through the direct power of God acting on those people who he wants to draw to himself. And that is just another way of saying grace. The term grace can be very problematic. The word grace can be interpreted as power, God's presence, but that this power and presence are something that he gives for reasons known only to himself. That there are certain people, for whatever reason, are chosen to live a very different kind of a life. And these are, in fact, the church. The church are these people who have been called out of this lower world and live a very, or at least supposed to live, a very different sort of a life based on the ascetic existence necessary to rise above the lower world of power, of cause and effect. The fact is, if you live and only care about this world of power and cause and effect, you have no intellectual basis on which to stand to criticize the wealthy and powerful who control your life, because these people have done nothing different than you. They have just, for whatever reason, been more successful at it. Only when you live amongst the forms, when you live amongst those truths of logos that are above and beyond simple cause and effect, and in fact create the world of cause and effect, this fallen world of power, only there do you have a place to sit. But if you accept the point of view of the banking or corporate or state establishment, that all there is power, and power exists for its own sake, then you have no right to complain that these people oppress you, because that's the nature of this world. Grace is God's presence with those people who he has chosen out of this world. That there is a structure to the world that has existed in God's mind from the beginning of time. And yet that has nothing to do with the fact that we are aware of choosing one course of life over the other. And ultimately this choice is, when it turns to the bad, it's really about choosing what is easy over what is true. Truth, living a life of truth, especially in our day and age, is almost impossible. We know that we are going to be marginalized. We are going to lose friends. We are going to lose family members. We may be persecuted in any number of ways. We may end up living in poverty because we refuse to conform ourselves to the bureaucracy and the technocracy of power that seeks to use this world for the aggrandizement of the elite. But for those who are capable of choosing something else, for those who have suffered, for those who see the system for what it is, whether it be the Roman system in Augustine's time or the New World Order in our time, in many ways there are certain areas of parallel. I mean, I think the Roman Empire was infinitely, even in its decadence, infinitely healthier than our present system. Nevertheless, it was still a imperialist, slave-driving system, however you slice it, regardless of their virtues. And St. Augustine is not shy in talking about the virtues of the Roman Empire. The only problem is, these virtues are always prostituted to domination, never to truth. It's the will, whether it be the will of the elite, the will of the state, the will of the army, the will of the economic elites, their desire is to live powerfully and reign at the expense of everybody else. People are mere means for them. So their virtues, while very real and self-sacrificing, no matter what happens, when push comes to shove, they are always prostituted to power, to domination, to imperialism. Now, I want to say here that ultimately, St. Augustine's concept of how we're to live centers around what becomes his monastic rule. His monastic rule actually doesn't get dealt with all that often. But he's talking about these people who want to dedicate themselves exclusively to the service of God and Logos within the church. And they're really, you know, seven general points. The first point is the centrality of living according to this rule. The rule is designed to bring us slowly but surely into greater experiences of God's presence on this world. The second point is that this rule creates harmony. What we're trying to live in is peace. We're trying to create peace. We understand that while we're alive, this peace can only be temporary. But the monastic tradition can bring us closer to it. And unity, true unity, has to be based on a habit of will that is dedicated to this kind of charity. And charity, defined as seeking happiness not in using people, but in viewing logos in people. There is a singularity of God's will and presence. Number three, St. Augustine, for his monks, rejects any concept of private property. Private property, usually in the patristic mind, and St. Augustine in particular, is not a human right. Private property exists because we are fallen creatures who seek to dominate others. Private property is something that we have because we have to have it. We demand it, not because it's necessarily a good thing. In the Garden of Eden, in the Golden Age, which all cultures have of humanity, there was no private property. People shared because they did not seek to dominate that which they came across. Our life on this lower world of cause and effect is based on division. It's based on multiplicity. It's based on us viewing ourselves as the center of the world. Private property is an analog to that. In fact, it derives directly from that. And yet the life of the Spirit is something different. As we said in the beginning of this program, it's about union and unification. Point number four, humility. This really follows naturally from the first three. We dwell with and we embrace those who are poor in every aspect of that word. Pride is the worst of all. You are not that great, no matter what you think of yourself, for at the very least you realize that there is this gap between how we view ourselves, our essence as rational beings, and in fact that we're dominated by our fallen will. Point number five, the rule of prayer, to keep the fixed hours of the church and the Psalms always in front of our minds. The Psalms are the way that the Spirit has communicated with humanity. Point number six, our basic behavior has to center around simplicity. We guard our eyes and we control our anger. And the only time where we seek to judge somebody is when we believe it will help and save that person, not because it makes us look pious and intelligent and scholarly. Spiritual love comes above and beyond natural love, because spiritual love is the only love that there is. Natural love is problematic. Natural love is about mutual using for the sake of what we think will make us happy. Natural love is this physical desire for domination, and yet spiritual love is this desire for unity in God. And lastly, point number seven, obedience. There has to be an obedience to the rule so long as the commands of the superior of the monastery are cognizant of the faith and derives from the faith. The abbot of the monastery is supposed to be an icon, and I've said this on this program before, bishops and abbots do not rule. They exhort and they show us how to act through their example, and that's why all bishops have to be monks. They have to come through this school, the 7 points that St. Augustine lays down. Now, for St. Augustine to conclude this, private property, the state, these are unnatural things, but these are necessary things given our fallen existence. The fact is that they are concessions to our weakness. They are certainly not human rights. Think of it this way, and this is how we're going to conclude tonight. St. Augustine, when he talks about politics, really has one central issue. Human beings are naturally social. We're naturally gregarious people. We form cultures and languages and seek a happy life in community. That's what we do naturally and normally. If the fall hadn't occurred, we would still be social and gregarious creatures. That is natural to humanity in all states, fallen and redeemed. However, man as political is not natural. Man as social is natural. The difference is because social life is about sharing culture and tradition in the formation of a people, and yet the political is about the control of the state for the sake of extracting resources. Ultimately, the state is necessary to provide a tolerable level of order, where, of course, anarchy would lead to the pure dominion of the strong. The state is really never itself going to become Christian. The state may veil itself with Christianity of one type or another, but ultimately the state is about power and control. And this is why we might be natural, naturally social, but we are not naturally political. The political, the state, this derives from sin and the need we have to be controlled in our often irrational behavior. In the Garden of Eden, man was social. Man, however, did not have government. Those are two very different things, and I think that that might serve to summarize a lot of what we've been dealing with here today, this question of will and what the difference is between a good will and a bad will and what God's role in all of this is and his interest for human beings. Anyway, there's a lot more here. This was just a thumbnail sketch of the basics of Augustine. But I am doing it by request, and I am a strong Augustinian, at least in politics and in metaphysics, as we've dealt with before, and people like Scovadora and others, and there's a very similar connection here. But that is the nature of the situation here, and I think Augustine is correct on many of his diagnostic thinking, whether it be Roman Empire or New World Order, ultimately it's the same problem. Okay, I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.